Welcome to the National Association for Christian Recovery's audio workshop series. Additional audio recordings of workshops and plenary sessions from NACR conferences can be found at our website, www.nacr.org. Just click on the word audio in the top menu. The following is a plenary presentation from STEPS 2005. Our presenter is Mark Laser. His topic is Three Spiritual Questions and the Process of Change. As always, we encourage you to take what works and leave the rest. Enjoy.
At these conferences that is dyslexic, and that is, I think the music should follow the speaking. Because, you know, it's been partly my lot in life at these conferences to follow great music, and I always feel like a little bit what we have to talk about after inspirational music like that is kind of redundant. But given the fact that I am an addict, how many of you think that that's going to stop me from speaking tonight? I was thinking earlier outside, just running into so many familiar faces that being at the STEPS conference is like being at, family week. Not necessarily at a treatment center, you understand. Just, I think since the beginning of my ministry in this area of sexual addiction, I started, for reasons that would take too long to explain, to come out here to California. And I've always felt a very special place for Southern California particularly, and for friendships like Dale and Juanita that, you know, have invited me to speak and included me in their activities over the years. So, you know, I'm grateful for that. It feels like, we're coming home, Dale. So thanks for us being here. I am a recovering sex addict and have been since 1987. I'm not going to tell my story tonight. I told it a little bit yesterday, and I've told it before. And what I want to talk to you about tonight is a couple of different things, really, a set of questions that strike me as being very significant spiritual questions that all of us who are addicts, all of us who are perhaps the spouses of addicts, we have to ask ourselves these spiritual questions. And so tonight I'd like to tell you what they are and just challenge you that even though you may be in recovery for, you know, long lengths of time, I would still encourage you to think about these questions for yourself, and then also feel free to use these questions in whatever ministries or counseling practices you have. All three of the spiritual questions are based on stories from the Gospel of John. And I was thinking tonight that mainly what I want to do is tell you stories from the Bible. The second half of what I want to say tonight, I want to talk to you about how people change, how people transform, and there, too, I'm going to be telling stories from the Bible. And it strikes me that I'd like to dedicate this to the memory of my father, who was a great storyteller. And most of the stories that I know from the Bible were stories that my dad told me for the first time when I was a small boy. My dad died about 5 weeks ago, so it feels a little bit like I'm in his legacy, although, as many of you know from my story, I'm also a sexual abuse survivor of his. But, you know, I want to dedicate this tonight to him just to kind of also demonstrate that healing and transformation is possible even when people have done some harm to you. So, anyway, the first question goes to the Gospel of John, the fifth chapter. And in the fifth chapter of John, there is this story about a pool that is outside the Sheep Gate in Jerusalem. All of the gates in Jerusalem have a function, and this gate was the one in which the sheep went for the sacrifice. When I was in seminary ancient days ago, thinking was that this gate did not exist and that the pool that was outside it did not exist. Probably it was some invented imaginary thing that the gospel writers were talking about to make a point. And about 6 or 7 years ago in Biblical Archaeology Journal, I read the fact that this pool was discovered. And it struck me when I read that that it sometimes takes science about 2,000 years to prove the validity of the Bible. But the deal with this pool was that the tradition had it that an angel would come down and stir the waters, and whenever the waters were stirred, whoever would jump into the pool first would be healed of whatever infirmity they had. And the Bible describes that by this pool there came to lie the blind, the lame, the paralyzed, the sexually addicted, the alcoholics. No, that's really not in there, but it's the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. And the Bible then says that there was a man who had been there, an invalid, paralyzed man, for 38 years. I like that because when I got to treatment in 1987, I was 37, so this guy had basically 1 year on me of being totally paralyzed. Now, Jesus comes across this scene, and I want to just pause for a moment and say to you that after all of my years of psychology and training and so forth, you know, I would consider that Jesus is our master psychologist. Now, that's a kind of an interesting thing to think because in all of my training, in all of my schools, Ivy League schools, Midwest universities, wherever else it happens to be, I would never have thought to ask the question that Jesus asks this guy. When I was in training, we were taught something back in the early 70s called active listening, which basically meant you sat by people and you didn't say anything. It was really kind of, I think, worthless, but the idea was that you wouldn't impose your will on somebody else. You would basically be too manipulative if you did that. So you sat there and you were silent until they said something, and then maybe you responded with a nod of your head or a yes, or, you know, maybe if you were really sophisticated, that must be hard or something like that. So, you know, in my training, I would have gone there and sat there, kind of like Job's friends in the Old Testament, Bildad, Eliphaz, and Zophar. You know, they sat with Job in all of his misery for 3 days before anyone opened their mouth. Maybe I would have been a fixer and said, you know, I can help you get into that pool first. I'm competitive. I'm strong. Let's get down there. Let's beat these other people. Maybe that would have been my approach. Maybe I would have been a diagnostician and I would have said, how did you get paralyzed in the first place? Maybe I would have been rigid, black and white theologically and said, you must have sinned in order to be like this for 38 years. Jesus doesn't go to any of those places. He asks him a rather interesting question. You know this story. He says, do you want to get well? Now, why would Jesus ask him that question? I mean, he's been there for 38 years. I mean, it would seem to me that the answer is obvious. Why am I laying by this stupid pool if I don't want to get well? But what does the guy say? He says, sir, I have no one to help me into the pool, and when I go down, someone else gets in my way. Does this sound, those of you that have done counseling, a little bit like the victim people that we sometimes talk to? I've had no therapist to help me. I've had no minister who understands. I've had no witness or testimony from another person who suffers with the same thing. And when I try to go down to some resource, you know, I just don't have enough money, something gets in my way, whatever the case. I like what Jesus does here. He doesn't really argue with the guy about any of that. He just says simply, get up. Take up your pallet and walk. Kind of proves the point that sometimes Jesus heals people even if they don't have enough faith that he can do it. But the first spiritual question for all of us is, do we want to get well? I was talking yesterday at lunch to Jeff Van Vonderen about all his wonderful work doing interventions. That's obviously one of the questions that's asked at an intervention. Do you want to get well? Do you want to go to treatment? Over the years, I've come to understand that the answer to this question is really not so black and white. When I first got into treatment back in 1987, there was a part of me that had been praying for 25 years for God to somehow magically take away from me, and since Dale used the word, all of my horniness. You know, all of my lust, all of my addictive desire. I wanted God to just remove it. I wanted him to do some kind of mental, spiritual surgery so that I didn't have this inappropriate sexual desire anymore. I wanted the magic solution. I was miserable. There were those hours when I prayed and prayed and went down front and did whatever I had to do. But there was another part of me, I think, that did not want to let go. of my addiction. There was a part of me that liked what I was doing. Since I was 3 years old and had been sexually abused, I had been preoccupied with sexuality, and I knew that sexual thinking, sexual fantasy, sexual activity later in my life, that seemed to me to be the answer to how I got my needs met. And I didn't want to give it up. In the book of James, James, who is reported by some to be the brother of Christ, says, those people, those men who cannot totally depend on God, they are like waves of the sea tossed to and fro. Those men, he says, are double-minded men. And I think that's what all addicts are. We are double-minded people. Part of us wants to get well and a part of us doesn't. It's kind of our original sin nature, you know, to maybe at some point in our addiction recovery say, you know, this was unmanageable. But on the other hand, part of what made it unmanageable is that we refused to surrender the will and the control of our life over to God because we were double-minded. So I think throughout the course of our life, even to this day, after 18 years of sobriety, there are plenty of days when I still need to ask myself the question, are you willing to stay sober? Are you willing to get well? Are you willing to go to the therapy even after all of these years? And you still find out that there's stuff in your life that makes you one of the most flaming codependents in the universe. Well, you know, I think we all struggle with those questions on a daily basis. Do we want to get well? And so I leave you with that question for yourself. And I think we all wrestle with it. I think those of us that are on a healthy journey at least accept the fact that we are not these 100% perfect recovering people. We have our flaws and our mistakes and our days when we wonder if we're in fact going to go to yet one more meeting. My encouragement is to accept that part of yourself and embrace it, not try to send it away someplace. Just understand it. It's part of who you are. It's part of what makes us human. And it's part of what makes us need God. The second question is from one chapter earlier in the Gospel of John. It's the story of the woman at the well of Samaria. And when Jim was singing tonight about being thirsty, that's the second question. What are you thirsty for? You know this story. It's a story of a woman. He has three strikes against her in biblical times. She's a woman, she's a Samaritan, and she's an adulteress. She's been living with five men. She's currently living with another guy. She's gone to the well of Samaria, Jacob's well, at the heat of the day around 12 noon because she doesn't want to be seen by any of the other respectable people who would come to the well when it's cooler. Isn't it always interesting to you that Jesus hangs out at some of these kind of places where he's going to encounter the worst of all sinners? When you think about a Billy Graham crusade, you think about all the advance work that goes into that. I know he was at the Los Angeles Coliseum not so long ago. You think of all the years of work that went into that one crusade so they could get to the heart of the city and tell the message to as many thousands of people as he possibly could. Why didn't Jesus ever do that? Now, Jesus never went into the village here where all the respectable people were. He was hanging outside so he could talk to one person, and that was this sinful woman on the edge of town in the heat of the day when neither one of them would be seen by anybody. So he goes to the well, and he's standing there, and this woman, who in fact is a very kind woman, says to him, "Sir, I notice that you have nothing to draw water with." And she is going to help him have a drink, and he says to her the famous words that you all know, "Sir," or not sir, or "ma'am, if you drink from this well, you will thirst again." When I hear those lines, I am reminded of the work that I used to do out in Port Hueneme, California, just down the 101. And I had the opportunity in those days to work with some rather famous people. I like talking about it because as a kind of a narcissistic person, I'm a name dropper. The problem with this is I can't drop any names. But I can kind of allude to it, you know. So there was this one guy who's still rather famous, and he said to me one day when I was taking his sexual history, which is one of the fun things that I got to do because I was the sex doctor in a CD recovery facility, and I got to listen to his history, and he told me that he'd had sex with over 3,000 women and that he'd spent $3 million on prostitution. And he looked at me in total despair and depression, and he said to me, you know, it was never enough. And when he said that, I was, you know, of course, remembering in my own addiction that there was always that one more time to act out, hoping that that one time would be something that would be enough to fill my soul. But it never was. Then Jesus says, of course, what I have to offer is living water. Well, the second question is, what are you thirsty for? Are you thirsty for things of this world, none of which will ever satisfy? Or are you thirsty for things above, which will? When Jim was talking about being from Tennessee, I was reminded of the fact that my mother's family is all from Dixon County, Tennessee, which is just outside of Nashville. A number of years ago, for some strange reason, I went out to Dixon County, and I found out that there was a cemetery dedicated to my mother's family, and we went to that cemetery. And I remember walking around the cemetery, looking at all the gravestones of all the women in my family going back for a couple of hundred years. And I remember thinking as I'm looking at those gravestones, is this where female nurture in my family died? Because my mother wasn't able to give it to me very well. She didn't talk to me. She didn't affirm me. She didn't touch me in healthy ways. I don't ever remember her coming to any of my events or sporting events or matches and so forth. And so obviously early on in my therapy, I did a lot of work on these abandonment issues with my mother. And I came to realize that a lot of my sexual addiction was a false attempt to find a solution to that desperate need inside myself for female nurture. And that was well and good for the early years of my recovery. And I knew that there was absolutely no woman on the face of the earth ever who has lived who could fill that deep hole inside of myself, but that's kind of where it stopped. And then I have a confession to make, and I hope I don't get struck by lightning here in a Christian group. I read the Da Vinci Code. I know it's not on the reading list of most acceptable evangelical churches, but it did kind of raise an interesting point, and that was, in the Christian church, what happened to the feminine side of God? Well, you know, in the Catholic Church, and I have a lot of Catholic friends, they took, I think, our deep need for feminine. What did they do with that? They gave it to Mary, the mother of Jesus, or as they would say, the mother of God. And they have more or less, it seems to me, and I'm not being critical, they have more or less deified Mary, and they more or less sometimes worship Mary. And I believe that the reason they do that is because they are expressing inside their soul that deep need that we all have for the feminine side of God. We've understood a whole lot about the masculine side of God. We call God the Father and so forth. And by the way, I'm not one of these feminist theologians necessarily that believes in priestesses and that kind of thing. I'm just longing somewhere for someone to start talking about the fact that God can be both male and female at the same time. The Bible, of course, says God created us in His own image, male and female, He created us. So God must have a male and female side. What happened to the female side? Well, without getting myself into more trouble talking about that too long, feels like in my evangelical guilt I need to keep going here. But I'm just saying that part of my quest today, and my therapist is encouraging me to do this, is to find the feminine in God that's perhaps even indwelling in my own spirit. So when I feel this deep hole inside for feminine love and nurture, maybe I'm looking to the wrong places out there in the world. Maybe I need to look inside myself and affirm that part of myself where God dwells in my soul. And God can be even feminine. Well, what do you thirst for in your recovery? And how can you look for that truly in God? One last thing about living water. I've often wondered exactly what that means. Well, it's something about water in the Bible that is about cleansing and salvation, obviously. Somebody the other day in my counseling practice gave me an image which I think is incredibly hokey, but it does seem to make sense to a lot of people. Because what is it that sometimes roadblocks us from accepting the living water of Jesus Christ? And they brought into my office a coffee filter full of coffee grounds. And they said to me, you know, Mark, when you pour water through this filter with the coffee grounds in it, what happens? And I said, well, what comes out looks like, smells like, tastes like coffee. He said, exactly right. If you look at my mind, it's a mind that's like a filter. And there's a whole lot of coffee grounds in the filter of my mind. A whole lot of experiences that were put there by the world. My abuse experiences, my addiction experiences, the things that were done to me, the things that I've done to myself. They're all inside there. And Mark, you can take the living water of Jesus Christ, and when you pour it through the filter of my mind, it still comes out smelling, tasting, and looking like I'm a bad and worthless person. And it convinced me of the importance of therapy and that we got to get at this coffee filter. And then the question becomes, do we get the grounds out? And as I understand the human memory and its neuroanatomical nature, we really can't. There's no year that's going to come when I don't have memories of harm and memories of trauma and memories of hurt that can get triggered in a heartbeat. But what I do know to be true, even neuroanatomically, I'm going to prove it to you tomorrow in my presentation at 11 o'clock. How's that for an advertisement? Is that we can override all those old grounds. The true way to deal with that filter is to dilute it with the truth, to put new stuff in it so that the living water can get through and look and smell like grace when it's finally filtered by our brains and our souls and our spirits. Well, what are you thirsty for? Then the last question is even, I think, deeper, more powerful in many ways. And it's from the Gospel of John, the 11th chapter. And I'll confess to you that I heard this preached by Ruth Graham Lotz, who is probably one of the most powerful preachers that I've ever heard. And it reminds me in our story of, what are you thirsty for? Who was it that preached the message of salvation in that village in Samaria? It was a woman. So let me just encourage all of you women who have something to say, say it. Well, Ruth Graham Lotz was talking about this story, which is the story of Lazarus. And I've never really thought about that other than it was a great miracle. Jesus brought somebody back from death. But when you think about this story, you know, it's really important to all of us in our recovery, I think. First of all, you know that in the beginning of the story, Lazarus gets sick, and he's been a friend of Jesus, and his sisters, Mary and Martha, are friends of Jesus. They're part of his inner circle. They've had him over for supper any number of times. He hangs out with them. So you like to think that when you're a friend of Jesus, you can send a message to him, and he will respond. And of course, they send him a note and said, Jesus, our brother is sick. Will you come? And of course, he doesn't come. And let me just pause for a minute and say, have any of you ever sent a message to Jesus and felt like he doesn't come? Like, where are you? Where did you go? What happened here? I'm desperate. I'm dying. I need your help. and you feel like he's not there. Well, of course, Lazarus dies. Have any of you ever sat in a treatment center and felt like you died? Said, you know, here I am, in my case, 37 years old. Lord, you could have done this when I was 15. And why did you let me wait this long to die? Well, I don't know. Just think about that for a minute, because Jesus lets Lazarus die. He malingers, whatever you want to call it. And finally, he comes back. And as he's approaching this village, first of all, Martha, who's a rational type, she rushes out there to meet him. And I think she's probably pretty civil about this. She says, Jesus, if only you had come, our brother wouldn't have died. Jesus tries to give her some theological response about who he is, and she gets it, and she understands, and she goes back home. Now, Mary, on the other hand, again, according to the Da Vinci Code, the one who's married to Jesus. I'm sorry I had to throw that in. But anyway, she's a little bit more impetuous. In our sophisticated psychological language, we might even say she was histrionic. She rushes out there. She throws herself at his feet, and she's clinging on for dear life, and she said, Jesus, if only you had come. How many of you have if-only questions for Jesus? If only you'd done this. If only you'd let me be born in another family, I wouldn't have had all that trauma. If only you had got me into recovery when I was 12. Where was Alateen when I needed it? Well, Jesus gradually comes back to the village. He sees all the sadness. And, of course, there is the shortest verse in the Bible there. Jesus wept. Now, why was he crying? Well, he wasn't sad about Lazarus. He knew he was going to bring him back to life. He was sad because he shares with us in our sadness whenever we feel it, I think. I also like to wonder sometimes, he knew that in not so very long time he would be in the tomb himself. Well, they go out to this tomb. Jesus says to Martha, roll away the stone. I like this part. Martha, being the rational one, says, Lord, we cannot do that. He's been in there for 4 days. According to the King James, he stinketh. He has a foul odor. Jesus says, roll away the stone. Of course, the greatest verse in this whole story is the end with Lazarus comes out. And he says, take off his grave clothes and set him free. Now, think about that, you addicts and co-addicts out there. I mean, have we not had that experience of dying? And I think there are times when Jesus lets us die so that he can be made manifest in his resurrecting power in our lives. When Jim is able to sing what he sings, is not that an example of the resurrection? Is that not a resurrected life that we witnessed tonight in song? He had to die. He had to go through some awful experiences like many of us have had. Well, you know, I think sometimes we just need to accept the fact that our story of dying is dying to ourselves, and it was only then that we could find Jesus. I think we all need to stop fighting against whatever our story of pain and trauma is. The last question is, what are you willing to die for? Addicts are so selfish and prideful that they think they can control their own universe. They're like Adam and Eve in the garden, and they believe that I just need a little bit of that knowledge and I can take care of myself. Sometimes we all need to die to ourselves in order to figure out who's really in control. Beyond that, then, who are you willing to die for? 9-1-1 was a horrific event, but it had some very powerful effects on all of us, didn't it? I want to speak for just a minute. I know there's some of you out here that are the baby boom generation like I am. You grew up in the 50s and 60s. Some of you, like I did, you sat around your homes or your college unions hoping that your draft number would be high, didn't you? Some of you had your conscientious objection papers filled out. Some of you had bought fake urine like this Minnesota Viking did several months ago to try to get out of something. And it was not fashionable back in those days to be very patriotic, was it? I want to speak to you guys for just a minute because were you not sometimes bothered when movies came out like Saving Private Ryan? At the end of that movie, which is about sacrifice, you found some tears welling up inside yourself. Tom Brokaw wrote a book called The Greatest Generation about my father and my father-in-law and all of those men in their now 80s or who have died who got on boats, went over to far-flung places, didn't ask about it, they just did it. Tom Brokaw said they were the greatest generation. They were people who were willing to sacrifice. Well, I always wondered about that, and I always felt guilty about that, someplace inside my spirit. And then 9/11 happened, and we saw some stories of sacrifice. I speak a lot to the Catholic Church, and there was a priest. You know, amidst all these other pedophilic priests, there was this one priest who went inside the building to do his job and lost his life in the process. And Tom Brokaw, strangely enough, was interviewing Rudy Giuliani about 3 days after this. And he was asking him about the cleanup effort, and finally he said, "Thank you, Mr. Mayor." And Rudolph Giuliani said, "Wait a minute, Tom, I have something I want to say to you." He said, "I think the genes of that greatest generation are alive and well here in New York City." And I wanted to say yes, because didn't all of you feel for a while that patriotic thought that maybe you would die for your country? I remember thinking that yes, I would. Given the right circumstances, I would die for my country. Would you die for your spouses? Would you die for your children? I think those are the questions all of us addicts need to ask ourselves, because you know what? Our addiction was about quite the opposite. It was all about us. It wasn't about anybody else. Well, that's my third question to you. In order to find Jesus, you've got to die to yourself, and you've got to be willing to die for something in order to take the risks necessary to stay well. Now I want to talk to you about the process of change. We're all in the middle of it, I think. How do we change? How do we transform? How do we go from being addicts and co-addicts to being healthy, mature people? Debbie and I, who's sitting here in the front row, and I'm so grateful always for the trips that she can come with me, we've been studying over the last several years one of the great teachers about counseling in the 20th century, Virginia Satir, and she had a model of how people change. And I'd like to just briefly tonight, because I don't have a whole lot of time left, talk to you a little bit about how people change, and I want to put it in the context of the Old Testament. Virginia said that people go from being in some kind of status quo where they are stuck, like addiction, to getting some new information about the fact that they need to change. I'd like for you all to think back to a day or a time when you first got some new information that you needed to change something like your addiction. My day, one of them was, I was counseling a guy who was having problems with masturbation, and there, Dale, I said that word here from a sanctuary. And he couldn't stop, and he wanted to stop, and his wife was having problems with it. And he said, "You know, Dr. Lazier, you've got to help me." And of course, I'm sitting there in the heat of my addiction, feeling like a fool and a hypocrite. And he had a book with him. It was called Out of the Shadows by Dr. Patrick Kearns. And he handed it to me, and he said, "Dr. Lazier," he said, "you need to read this book so that you can help me." I hate it when that happens. So I said, okay, and I took it home, and that night I read page one, and I had to close it because I knew it was about me and I wasn't ready yet. But I had the new information. There was a term for that which I was experiencing. It was called sexual addiction. I said, that's me. But I wasn't ready. And that's what happens to us when we get some new information sometimes. We're not ready to change. Virginia talked about the fact we come up against this barrier. And how many times before you finally got sober did you come up against this barrier and you continually went back to your addiction? It was like a ping pong match, wasn't it? Finally, something bumps us across the barrier. You remember that first year of recovery? Did it not feel to you a little bit chaotic? Like, Lord, you said this was going to be better if I got repentant and went home, and now I'm sober, but it doesn't feel a whole lot better. Do you remember those days? Did it get kind of discouraging because now you weren't medicating yourself in the old ways, and all the pain from the past was coming into your mind, and you say, holy cow, this feels terrible. Maybe I should go back to my addiction. And some of us hang in there. And we get to another stage in the journey where we keep practicing things that our sponsors are telling us and our therapists are telling us. And we're practicing some new kinds of behaviors. And we're doing it because other people are telling us to do it, not because we know that it's going to work, just we trust somebody else. Finally, if we practice enough, we begin to integrate it into our own life. And when we integrate it into our own life, that which we've practiced now for 2 or 3 years becomes more familiar than that which we knew in our addiction. And finally, because it is more familiar, it becomes the new status quo. Virginia said, when we enter into this journey of change, there's about 95% of us that doesn't want to go, that feels anxious about it. But it's that 5% sometimes that bumps us along. So the next time you have a change to make, it may be 90-10, and then 85-15. And finally, now maybe after 20 years of recovery, when you have to make a change, it's 50-50. But I want to put this in the context of the Old Testament story of the Jewish people coming out of the land of Egypt, because I want to make one dramatic point about how people change. You know the story of the Jewish people. They got down to Egypt. Why? Because they were hungry. They had sold their brother Joseph into slavery, and he was down there and he started interpreting dreams. This was well before Sigmund Freud. Debbie and I were in a used bookstore today on Colorado Boulevard and found an original copy, it seemed like, of Sigmund Freud's book, The Interpretation of Dreams. Well, Joseph was doing that back in the Old Testament. He got himself into a great position, forecast the future, had prepared for the famine that was going to come, so that the Egyptians weren't hungry, but the Jewish people were hungry, and that's what got them down to Egypt. Several generations later, there was a Pharaoh who didn't remember Joseph, and all those Jews that were living down there, they got made into slaves. And isn't that the story of our addiction? We came to some place because we were hungry for something, and after a while, we wound up slaves. Well, God decides eventually to intervene on this, and he gives some new information to some people. First of all, to Moses on Mount Sinai. He appears to him in a burning bush, and he said, you know, Moses, I got some new information for you. Here's my name. My name is Yahweh. I am who I am, and that's all you need to know. Go down to tell Pharaoh, let my people go. That was new information. Moses said, you know, I'm wanted for murder down there. I don't think I can speak very well. He had excuses, and God said, go down there and do this. Take your brother with you. So they did, and they had some new information for Pharaoh. What do you think happened when Pharaoh first heard that news? Let my people go. Well, we know what happened. There was 10 visitations of plagues. Pharaoh had a case of atherosclerosis. So, you know, his heart was hard, and he finally had to, you know, get it softened and let him go. So now they're, because of the new information, they're out on that second stage of the journey, and they come up against their barrier, and what do we call it? The Red Sea. Of course, Pharaoh now has had one more change of heart. He's chasing after them with all of his chariots. They hear the hoofbeats of the horses, and they're standing there on the banks of the Red Sea. And what do all the people feel like they need to do? Edward G. Robinson in the movie The Ten Commandments said it to Charlton Heston. He said, why did God bring us out here into this place to allow us to die? that let's lay down and go back to Egypt. Well, we know what God does. Of course, he parts those waters. He lets them get through. Now, if my analogy is applicable to all of us today, what in the heck is the Red Sea for all of us? The other day, and when I say the other day, it could be anything from yesterday to 10 years ago. The other day, I was working with a client, and I was doing one of these experiential psychodynamic things that I had learned from our therapist. And I said, you know, you've had a lot of sadness and trauma and loss in your life, Jamie. Would you take out a Kleenex box every time you say to me out loud what one of those losses are? And after an hour and a half session, he had taken out an entire box of Kleenexes, crumbled them up, thrown them on the floor. And I'm sitting there in my chair and I'm looking down on the floor, and it came to me. It was a sea of Kleenex, a sea of sadness. It was Jamie's Red Sea. Now, how many of us have gotten kind of stuck because we know that our trauma, our pain, our loneliness, our sadness is so deep that we think if we start crying about it, we're going to drown in a sea of our own tears? Well, you know what happened, at least I think for me, when I started letting those tears out, God was in that process. He parted the way. He showed me people to walk with me, including Debbie. And you know what? You get to the other side. I've never known anyone who's drowned in their own sorrow once they start talking about it. Well, then, though, we get to the other side. And in our story of the Jewish people, what happens? They get to the desert, don't they? Now, are they trusting God yet? They've seen his hand 10 times in Egypt, one time here parting the Red Sea. You'd like to think, after visible demonstrations like this, they would trust God. Do they?
No.
No, they say, you know, what are we going to eat, Lord? I like this as a 12-stepper. He says, I'm going to give you manna, and I'm going to give it to you for one day at a time. If you try to gather the second day, it will rot. So eat one day at a time. And they do that. Now God has provided for them water and food. You think now they trust him? Moses goes up to Sinai to get the Ten Commandments. And what happens then? They built a false idol. And how many of you in your addiction, after you got recovery from alcohol or drugs or whatever it was, you found another false idol? For me, it might be work or eating or watching television or some of the other addictions that I developed along the way. I have a lot of false idols. I can get out into the desert, and even though I might start to feel some of the chaos, I can go to other false idols. Well, these people are just not getting it. After 2 years of this, Moses says, you know, I believe on faith we can go to this place God promised us. And he sent out 12 spies, one from each of the 12 tribes. You can read this in Numbers 13 and 14. It's a rather fascinating story. They go out there, they scout out the land, they come back, they brought milk and honey, the fruits of the land. And are they confident? 10 of the guys say, you know, Moses, we got over there and we saw the land and it was a wonderful place, but we're not going there. It's full of giants. And we seem like grasshoppers to them. We're going to get eaten alive if we even think about crossing the River Jordan. There were two guys that stood up, Joshua and Caleb, and they said, we can do this with God's help. And what did the people out loud say collectively? Shut up. The Bible says in Numbers 14, that night the people wept aloud. They had a rather good leader, don't you think? A guy who talked to God, seen God. God told him his name, Moses. What do the people want to do? Said, let's fire Moses. Let's pick a new leader. And where do they want to go? They wanted to go back to Egypt. Well, you know, God got a little angry at this. Did this generation of people ever go to the promised land? No, they didn't have enough faith. They died. The Bible says their bones were bleached white from the sun. except for two guys in their 80s, Joshua, strangely enough, and Caleb, now about 85 years old. 40 years later, the next generation finally gets convinced to cross the River Jordan. Now, what is this river, by the way? I'm fond of these bodies of water that we have to cross. It's a rather shallow river, actually. It doesn't take much effort to get across it. But what's on the other side? Lots of things to be afraid of. Lots of giants. I think the River Jordan in our life is the river of risk. What risks are you willing to take to move forward? Are you confident that God can get you there? God will take care of you? Are you stuck on the west bank of the River Jordan, not ready to take the final leg of the journey into the promised land that God told you you can have? Well, they get over there. God has a rather interesting military strategy, doesn't he? I want you to take the most well-fortified city in the area, and what I want you to do is I want you to march around it for 7 days, blowing your trumpets. And then on the seventh day, I want you to march around 7 times and blow your trumpets, and then all will be well. How do you think that sounded to the West Point graduates in the crowd? Well, it worked, of course. God said, you know, I'm going to give you this city, but I don't want you to take any of the gold and silver for yourself because it belongs to me. But there was in this group one guy by the name of Achan who didn't obey God. He took some of the silver and gold and he buried it in his tent. The next day, Joshua says, you know, we got this little village nearby called Ai, and we need to kind of clean this up, send a group of 100 or so soldiers over there, take that village, and, you know, we'll keep moving forward here. Well, they go up to this village, which is not fortified, doesn't have a wall, and they run up against the enemy, and 65 of them are slaughtered. And they come dragging back to Joshua, and Joshua hears about the losses. And after all of these years, 85 years of seeing the hand of God, he goes into his tent, according to Joshua 5, and he goes in face down, and he says, Lord, why did you bring us over here to this promised land in order to allow us to die by the sword? What does God say to him? Get up. I told you that if one guy disobeyed my commands, I would have some consequences. It's kind of an interesting story. I don't like the result in that Achan and his family are all killed. But I think it does reveal the fact that if even one person in our community disobeys the will of God, it kind of has an effect on all of us. Well, finally, the Jews keep struggling. They finally win the promised land and so forth. Do they ever quite get it in terms of depending on God? Not really. Because at the end of our story of the Jewish people, God finally has to send his only son because that's the only way they do get it. Now, where are you on this journey of change? Are you still stuck in the old status quo? Are you somewhere bouncing back and forth between that barrier? Are you in a land of chaos wondering if it's going to get any better? Are you facing some challenges and you're not quite willing to take the risks? Are you practicing? Are you trying to integrate? Are you trying to trust God more? That's the message of change. Over time, it's learning how to trust God more, one day at a time. Are you willing? Are you thirsty for God? Are you willing to die to yourself? If you are, I think we can change anything. Any life can be transformed. I thank you for listening to me tonight. I'd like to close us in prayer, if that's okay. Then again, that's my training. I have to ask if it's okay because I am codependent. Is it okay? No, okay. All right. Lord, I thank you for this group of people, all of whom have known your change and your transforming touch. And I just pray that the words of my mouth will be acceptable to them, and that they will take what they like and use it for good in their own lives and in the lives of their ministries. Help us all to be willing to trust you more. Help us all to be thirsty for living water. Help us all to be willing to die to ourselves and know that only you can be the resurrecting part of our lives. Help us to take risks. Help us to be willing to change. Help us to be in community that's safe, where all of us are depending on you. And Lord, we just so humbly ask these things, and we ask them in Jesus' name. Amen.